Welcome to the Lou Cutino Show, where we can learn to reimagine our lifestyle.
Dr. Judith, thank you so much for being on our show, the Lou Cutino Show, Reimagine Your Lifestyle. It's an honor and privilege to have you. You know, I travel so much to New York, and every time I see an Instagram post, anyone in New York who's doing so much of work in the space of mental and emotional health, it just intrigues me because we have patients between both these countries. And it's fascinating to see the diverse knowledge you have on so many different subjects. Now, I would do injustice trying to introduce you because I went through all of everything you've studied from biology right up to being a doctor and moving to one of New York's top psychiatrists. I would love for you to take us through your journey. Take us through your journey from your hometown to the United States of America, all of those amazing awards that you've just won as well. Would love to hear from you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. So I am a psychiatrist. I'm a medical doctor and I do therapy and medication management, but I wasn't always a psychiatrist. I started off as an anesthesiologist in the operating room because my parents were like, okay, you have to be a real doctor. Psychiatrists aren't real doctors. They're hanging out with crazy people all day, which is not true, but you know, that was the belief. My parents are from the Caribbean and in Trinidad, where a large portion of the population originally is from India. My mom's family is from Hyderabad. So, you know, like I switched from anesthesiology to psychiatry because it wasn't feeding my soul. You know, I didn't feel fulfilled and I haven't looked back. And I always say that psychiatry saved me because I was going through this existential crisis where I was like, well, what's the point of working this hard? You know, having all these degrees, if you're going to make a lot of money, but not be happy. Right. And so psychiatry is a field where you can see patients in therapy. You can prescribe medications. You can do research. You can have your own practice where you can do media work. And I found that I could do all of the things that I love doing a field that I feel really gratified in. So I'm really grateful to be both a psychiatrist treating patients who are children and adults and families and couples, also doing research, exciting research in psychiatry, developing medications and treatments along with pharmaceutical companies, and also doing media where I'm reaching millions of people every day. So it's really exciting and I'm so fortunate to be here.
No, thank you. Thank you for that. How's your experience been in New York? Were you always in New York once you moved to the US or did you practice in different states across the country?
I've pretty much been in New York since I moved here for medical school. So I went to Columbia, which is a medical school in New York City. And even when I was a medical student, I just felt like, okay, I want to learn more about different things. So I enrolled in the MBA program along with the MD program because they had this new program where you could get both a dual degree. So I've always been in New York. But New York is very fascinating. There are different boroughs, different parts of New York. They're very different neighborhoods. And of course, people from all over the world.
Yeah, I love New York. That's one of my favorite cities as well. And, you know, I wanted to talk about, you know, you've learned so much. And when I look at your content, and you're so generous with the amount of information that you share on social media, you know, I see you talking about diverse subjects, toxic relationships, mother-in-law problems, you speak about ADHD, bipolar, and everything else. You know, before we go into a little bit of detail, I wanted to ask you, your years of practice up till now, what are some of the most fascinating cases that you enjoy working with? And what are some of your learnings from those cases that you would share with us today?
I would say that, you know, being in research allows me to see just about everything. And a lot of times, people who are interested in the research studies, they are on medicine or they're in treatments and it's just not working. They're not experiencing significant reduction in their symptoms. So some of my most memorable cases are with postpartum women, people who come in who they're happy that they have a new baby and yet they're struggling. And it's one of those conditions where as a mother, you're just not allowed to give up because there's a child that depends on you. You know, people don't really sympathize as much with you because they think, okay, well, you should be happy. You have a healthy baby. What is there to be upset about? they don't understand that there are shifts in your hormones, that, you know, things happen in your brain during the third trimester up until after you give birth, where hormonal shifts can really impact your mood. So you can be grateful that you have a healthy baby. At the same time, you know, you have these hormonal changes. Your sleep is interrupted because the baby needs you around the clock. You're physically recovering because pregnancy is a major, major trauma. You know, I always tell my patients, when you're filling out your past medical history, make sure you're listing all the pregnancies that you had, because a pregnancy is a major medical event. So, you know, you're dealing with all of these things, and then you're not allowed to be unhappy. You're not allowed to say that you're exhausted, that you're burnt out. So it's a unfortunate part of, you know, our medical history in terms of physicians that we kind of like dropped the ball on. It wasn't until very recently that postpartum depression was even included in the DSM-5, which is the Bible of psychiatry. We know that postpartum depression has always existed. Just because it wasn't included in this Bible of psychiatry doesn't mean it wasn't there. And, you know, up until recently, you know, there were no FDA approved medications for it. So it's an unmet need. I think because it affects women, and, you know, the history of medicine hasn't been that kind with women. You know, we weren't even studying women in clinical studies up until very recently. So there's a huge gap to be filled. And it's exciting now because we have, in some cases, more women doctors in training than men. So it's a shift, a paradigm shift. And I think that, you know, we're going to see a lot of innovation in this area of medicine and psychiatry.
Dr. Judah, thanks for that. You know, since we're talking about postpartum, you know, I've experienced a lot of patients who realize, like, way after, you know, way after delivering the child and going through a couple of months, that they actually had it. They start to relate to it very late. What are some of the symptoms that women can kind of identify with when they're going through postpartum, or probably when it's just beginning to set in them, so that they're aware that, hey, you know, because a lot of them, for the first time, they think, hey, this is part of it all. And they just go through the journey, and a year later, they realize, oops, when they know about the symptoms, that's what I went through. And sometimes it's a little too late. They've already affected their physical health, their emotional health, and also relationships. So could you help us with some of the symptoms that women can identify?
Yes. You know, a lot of times women experience the blues. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in some studies, as much as 80% of women will experience postpartum blues, sadness, tearfulness, irritability, but it's not significantly impacting their functioning. They can still take care of themselves. They can still take care of their children. Their work isn't affected. But in other women, it's more intense. So they will have feelings of sadness, irritability, poor sleep, poor concentration, feelings of hopelessness, you know, not enjoying things, something called anhedonia, where you have a lack of interest and pleasure in things. They may even experience decreased appetite, extreme, you know, shifts in their weight, decreased interest in sex. So things that make life worth living, basically. And then they may have thoughts that life isn't worth living anymore. They may have thoughts of suicidality. In very, very extreme cases, they can have a postpartum psychosis, where they're starting to have hallucinations, delusions. They may want to harm their baby. So this can be very serious if untreated. And really, you know, what I say is, if you are not able to function and take care of yourself and others, if you can't do your daily duties, don't ignore it. That's when you should be asking for help. And in some cases, with every pregnancy that you have, it gets worse. So all the more reason to start, you know, therapy right away. If you don't want to take medications, you know, there are certain therapies that are shown to help with coping with depression if you're not someone who wants to take medication. So there are things that you can do to prevent a very severe postpartum depression.
So doctor, in the process of pregnancy, before the delivery of the child, is there anything that the mother can do, or the husband as well? Both, I mean, both of them have to play a part to kind of reduce the chances of postpartum, or is it just a hormonal thing and it can go either way?
Well, if you've had a history of anxiety and depression, you're going to be at more of a risk to develop a postpartum depression. So empower yourself with the knowledge of your medical history. And so if you know that you have had a history of these episodes, start to plan to work with a therapist. because therapy can sometimes be just as effective as medication in certain cases. Mm-hmm. So setting that up is really crucial. Creating a postpartum plan. You know, we always read these books like what to expect when you're expecting, and we're getting the nursery ready, but we're not thinking about taking care of ourselves afterwards. And, you know, I'm a mother, so I know that it can be very isolating when you give birth. So set things up for after you give birth. So you may want to ask friends in advance, you know, do you think you can come by on this day or on that day to help me out with the baby sometimes? You can talk to your partner or your family members and say, you know, there are going to be times when I need to take a walk. There's going to be times when I need designated rest time. You know, you may have to hire more help, and that's okay too. I have a lot of mothers who will hire one or two nannies to help them if they have the means, or, you know, utilize daycare where they have the ability to drop the child off for a couple of hours and just rest. You know, there are postpartum support groups that are there online or in person so that you're with other mothers who are bringing their children to these support groups. Setting up a lactation consultant, that's super important because it's very frustrating when you're a mother and you're trying to, you know, breastfeed your child and you, it's not working, they're not latching, you're getting frustrated. So yeah. There are supports that you can set up in place. I've even had people have, you know, like, you know, postpartum parties where people come by with food. So they're bringing food for you for the week. So you don't have to think about meal prep, you know, things like that, creative ways to create a sense of community, because we know that feeling connected to your community, to your friends, to your family is one of the greatest things that you can do to support your mental health, especially when you're depressed.
I love the last point that you mentioned about community. So if it can make a difference when a woman's going through postpartum, what about a relationship where a woman feels all alone after childbirth? Maybe the husband's traveling or busy or probably not involved. Can that also trigger off postpartum?
It can. And I've seen postpartum in the partners, in the men, where the men just, you know, it's not the same. They're not hormonal, but yeah. It's like this massive change in life. So sometimes the men will just cope by not being there. They'll schedule work unconsciously and sometimes consciously just to avoid dealing with the stress of a new baby, because babies are stressful. They change everything. So if you're in a situation where your partner isn't present and they travel and they're busy, then predict that, you know, predict asking for help in advance. So have that open, honest conversation with your partner, like, you're going to be away. I'm going to be here with this child and I'm going to feel very alone. So how can we come up with a plan for when this baby comes so that I feel supported? And it may require your partner asking his family members to step in. It may require, you know, setting up a schedule where your partner's aware that you're going to need certain people coming in the house to help you. It may require, you know, your partner minimizing their travel, or, you know, adjusting their schedule so that they're checking in with you on FaceTime or Zoom or whatever it is. But you want to anticipate that. Don't wait till the baby comes to plan it, because just anticipate that you're going to need more support.
Wow. I never thought of it that way, actually. Yeah, because that happens a lot, you know, in India. I mean, I'm talking about India because I'm here right now. You know, there are a lot of businessmen and a lot of families. They get married, they have children, but business continues, people travel. And I think this is solid information that you've just provided for the men as well. And, you know, there's always a fear of medication. So a woman going through postpartum, she may think that, hey, if I'm feeding, will this medication, you know, affect me? Will it affect the child through my milk? So could you throw some light on that, please?
It's a very valid fear. However, there are certain antidepressants that are not as present in the breast milk, or certain anti-anxiety medications that are not as present in the breast milk as others. So medications like Paxil and Ativan, there have been numerous studies on it showing very little effect on the child. If you dose at a certain time and the half-life has already passed and you pump, you know, you can also pump, store, and then take some of these medications. There are things, at least in the US, called breast milk banks, where healthy individuals donate their breast milk so that, and then they make sure it's clean and so forth so that you can utilize that. So there are ways around it. And then the new drugs that are the IV medication that's FDA approved, the pill was just approved, but it's not yet on the market. those were shown to have very, very little effects on the breast milk. So there are other ways to go around it. Mm-hmm. If you really, really, really don't want to do medications, because you're a lot of times OCD, so obsessive thoughts travel with depression. So patients will become very obsessed about things getting into the breast milk, and then it just derails them. So if you really don't want to do medications, there are therapies that you can do. And a lot of the therapy centers and the providers allow you to bring your child, because they want to observe the way that you bond with your child. They want to give you feedback so that you're, you know, coping with this in a way that isn't, you know, causing your child to feel anxious or depressed along with you. So there are therapies that are effective in helping the situation, even if you don't want to take medications.
Got it. That's fair. And do you think the health of a mother before getting into pregnancy, or just before, or trying to stay healthy and fit in terms of nutrition, exercise, sleep, you know, the spirit, emotional wellness, plays a role in possibly reducing postpartum?
Absolutely. You know, no one really sits us down in school and says, okay, this is how you be a good parent. Like, no one does that. No one teaches us how to pick a good partner. You know, they just say, okay, like, you know, look at what your parents did and you repeat, you know? And so I feel like things are changing, especially for the younger generations. People are starting to learn about what healthy attachment is, how to recognize red flags in toxic individuals, how to be a positive attachment figure to your child. And, you know, one study I looked at recently showed that millennial fathers are taking more of an active role in their children's care compared to Gen X fathers. And so I think that, you know, the younger generations, they're really driven to undo some of the harmful patterns that have happened in their families. And so they want to show up in a way that allows, you know, these generational patterns that are toxic to stop. They want to end those patterns. So, you know, taking care of your wellness, taking care of your mental health, making sure that you're not around toxic people, limiting your exposure to alcohol and substances, eating foods that feed your brain that are not as processed, getting meaningful movement, making sure that you're living a meaningful life, like doing things that you feel that you're spiritually fed. Those are all things that you can do to support your mental health and well-being before you decide to take on a role as a mother or a father or a parent.
And that's amazing. I think you just spoke about what the importance of lifestyle medicine is. And since we're talking about just postpartum, would that be applicable to any patient who comes to you, whether it's an ADHD, bipolar? The importance of lifestyle, it matters for anything that you treat with medicine or therapy?
Yes, absolutely. We're all human beings. You know, even from my youngest patient who's 4-year-old with ADHD, or an 8-year-old with autism, or my 90-year-old patient who has dementia, lifestyle matters. You know, there are some studies that show that for people with Alzheimer's dementia, going on walks every day, you know, taking active steps in keeping your social connections alive, that helps to stave off dementia. You know, we're on this hunt to fix this neurological condition, but the tools are already here. We're just not using them, you know? And so I think that it applies across the board.
Yeah, we've seen that with our Alzheimer's patients over the age of 65. They have the whole sunset syndrome. And when you put them out in the sun in the evening when it's setting, the entire mood is completely different compared to the days that they don't get sunlight. So yeah, I completely agree with you. The power of lifestyle, it matters whether it is medicine or therapy. You know, I loved the one post that you put up on Instagram and on Twitter about high functional depression. I've never heard that term before, but as I went sliding through the pages, I was like, wow, I'm like fitting in people into every part of that, you know, post. Like, hey, I think he fits into this, she fits into this. And some part of it was like, hey, do I fit into this? You know, and it just makes you think, like, you know, the way we're moving in life, flying all over the world, just being busy all the time. Doctor, I would love for you to explain high functional depression, you know, in detail with a couple of examples. And I'm sure our audience would be trying to see, hey, do I fit in over here or not? And would love also, you know, for you to talk about what are the top tips that we can start to identify if we have this and what we can do about it. Yeah.
So, you know, during the pandemic, my lab stayed open because a lot of the drugs that I was working with are not yet FDA approved. So I had patients in clinical studies. You can't just say, okay, COVID happened, bye. You know, you're taking this investigational product. We have to be monitoring you. So, you know, I was enrolling patients in studies for depression, and time and time again, people will come in and they'll say, I think something's off. I can't put my finger on it. So I'd use the DSM-5, do the checklist, and like, okay, do you have this? Do you have this? Do you have this? Do you have this? Well, according to the DSM, depression is supposed to significantly impair your functioning or cause distress. And a lot of patients weren't fitting into that nice, neat box, right? So you can't enroll them in a clinical study. But throughout the course of the pandemic and even years after, I just kept having to reject patients. And I started thinking, what if we got this all wrong? You know, when the DSM was created, you had people, experts in a room saying, this is this, this is that, this is that, based on trends they were seeing in research. But what if there's a whole chunk of people that have, you know, distress, but it's not impairing their functioning. They have, you know, they're kind of going through life, trudging along, not really enjoying life, experiencing anhedonia. They don't know how to classify anhedonia yet because it's something that they never even heard of. You know, they're people who work hard, but don't enjoy their wins. They feel restless when they're not working. They feel like they can't enjoy praise. And, you know, they're so busy, they don't take the time to really save a life. So I just thought, okay, I'm seeing trends in these patients. Let me just make a reel and see if anyone else agrees. You know, I expected maybe like 100 people. I did not expect the reel to go viral, you know? And I thought, okay, well, maybe it was because I paired it with this like viral song, you know? So then I did another reel on high function depression, went viral again. And then people are like, oh my gosh, this is me. This is me. Are you watching me? Do you have a camera in my house? Like how are you doing this? And I thought, this is a thing. And the interesting thing is that I thought about high function depression because I was giving a talk to medical staff in hospitals who, again, they work really hard. They experience high levels of burnout. They work like nonstop, not knowing what their purpose is. You know, they know there's a purpose that they started with in training, but then along the way they get lost. They busy themselves to avoid feeling empty and distracted. They don't enjoy things the way they used to, but they don't make time for it. And I thought, you know, what if this high functioning depression is the result of, you know, capitalism and our society going through multiple traumas and never processing the traumas. And, you know, us thinking that, okay, it's more important to have this facade on the outside versus feeling fed on the inside. So then I started wanting to research it. So I just started the first clinical study on high functioning depression, trying to figure out if there's a phenotype, if some of these things that I'm seeing identified in followers on Instagram can be classified in a clinical study to say, these are the traits of people who identify with having high functioning depression. Everyone in the study has to be high functioning, right? Yeah. In medicine, we don't focus on people unless they're in distress or unless they're not functioning. Mm-hmm. And that's a mistake because then we're only getting the tail end of the spectrum. We're only getting people who are burnt out, who are, you know, in a state of disarray, who are really, really beyond the preventative health measures, who have like at the far end. But what if we looked at people before they got to this stage, before they got so severe that their functioning is impaired? What if we focus on these people and rather than using medical codes to reimburse ourselves because we can justify treatment because they've lost functioning, what if we shifted and we looked at preventative health? And so I think that when we think about it that way and we think of these are people who on this mood spectrum do meet criteria for depression. They may not meet criteria for a major depressive disorder, but eventually they will. If they continue down this line, they're either going to self-medicate with drugs or alcohol. They're going to have a major depressive episode. They're going to have suicidality, or they're going to have some medical condition because their body just gave out, right? So I think that if we look at the high functioning people before they get to that extreme, we can prevent a whole slew of health issues. So I think it's a mental health and a physical health crisis.
No, I think your research is, you know, I mean, it's amazing how you thought of the idea. Because, you know, we have a lot of high functioning people as patients and clients. And, you know, over the last 13 years of my practice, I've stopped asking the question, are you happy? Because I just think it's not the right question. So we come up with questions. Do you feel cared for? Do you feel a sense of belonging to someone? Do you enjoy when your company does well or you get an award? And we get most of the answers as no. And then this one word that's coming up from high functioning people is, Luke, I have so much, like so much. And we have some people who say, my money can take care of the next couple of generations. But we feel hopeless. And they're like, I don't understand this feeling. We have people in the film industry. We have people in the royal family. And they're like, Luke, we have everything. But why do I feel empty all the time? And it's always struck me, you know, first, like, you know, so we would do the normal stuff. Are you being grateful? Are you doing your gratitude journal? And I was like, it's not that. There's so much of emptiness and hopelessness. And that also links with some of the factors of depression when we actually see our patients of depression. You know, we work with their guts and everything like that. So I was really intrigued to see this. So how could, for example, I'm going to use myself as an example. If I'm a high functioning person, how will I identify this? Is it with certain words like, hey, I do so much, I'm doing a great job, but I feel hopeless, I can't enjoy life. What are these top 4 or 5 points that I could, you know, go through the checklist?
So what you're experiencing is spot on. And that's what's in our clinical research. One of the questionnaires says, do you feel empty? Do you feel things less intensely, emotions less intensely? Do you feel restless when you're not busy? You know, because you're right. These are individuals who are, they're not just billionaires. Mm-hmm. They're not just sports people, competitive sports athletes, because you see this a lot in sports. Initially, the person starts off very passionate about the game, like loving the skill of it. But then eventually, after you win so many times, you kind of become numb to it. It's almost like an addiction to winning, an addiction to money. The more you get the drug, the less high you get. Mm-hmm. And so you see this anhedonia, which is a word that I'm trying to really reintroduce into the common language, this lack of pleasure, this lack of interest. You see this highly prevalent in people with high functioning depression, but you also see anhedonia in substance abuse and substance misuse. Mm-hmm. And I think the correlation is because we get addicted to the wins. We get addicted to the money. We get addicted to the lifestyle, but it's no longer making us happy. It's no longer giving us that high, right? But we don't know how to stop. If we stop working, if we stay still, we become so restless because we don't want to miss out on it. And I think it's a product of capitalism. And I think it's a lot of unprocessed trauma, because in our study, we look at the correlation between traumas that people don't even realize they've had, right? Because they've become so busy in life, they don't process, they're not insightful. So one of the things that we do in our study, and I won't give away all the things because it's not yet published, but we ask people to think back to a time in their lives when they didn't feel this way, when they could identify feeling satisfied, feeling fed, feeling full, right? Similar to how I felt when I was in anesthesiology and I was like, oh, this is a really great field. You know, I'm going to make a lot of money. It's prestigious, but I wasn't feeling full and fed. And I thought to myself, when was the last time I felt full and fed? And it was actually when I was a medical student and I was in an orphanage in South Africa doing trauma-focused groups with little children whose parents had died of HIV and AIDS. And they were pouring their souls out saying, no one's ever talked to us about this. No one ever thought we would live, you know? And I was like, wow, like I'm making a difference. I'm actually connecting with people. I'm actually feeling full and fed. That's what led me back to psychiatry. So I ask my clients, when was the last time you felt full and fed? Some of them can readily identify it and they can go back to a time in their lives when things were very different. And then we try to get them back to doing those things, right? And many times it's way before they were successful, when they had very little and they weren't around as many toxic people, when they're around more real people, right? When they were making more of an impact with just a little bit and not so much. For others, they have a really hard time identifying that period. So we have to do a lot more work with them, a lot more reflective work. We may have to become little investigators and go back through their journals, their pictures, you know, things that jog their memory, but we eventually get our way back there. And everyone has a different story. But I think that one of the things you can focus on is the values. What are the things that make your life purposeful, meaningful, and invest in that? Many people with high functioning depression, they don't really spend time with the people that matter the most in their lives because they're so busy. And they take for granted the children in their lives, the siblings, the adult siblings in their lives, the friends that shared the most meaningful memories with them, they somehow got lost along the way. So whatever it is that brings your life value and meaning, you've got to reconnect with that. That's one of the things we do in our research study. We look at that. But you know, when we publish it, I'll share the rest of the things that we did.
I can't wait for that to come. Now, that's powerful. That is so, so powerful. I think just that one question that you said, you know, how can we connect back with the things and people that make us happy? Most people would find their answers there. Yeah, I'm waiting for that to happen. But, you know, just going back to that, we also noticed, I wanted to share an observation, and these high performance people, the high functioning people, the ones who have this sense of hopelessness and emptiness, they're also high on devices, you know, the overdoing it on alcohol, substances. So I guess it kind of connects in exactly with what you're saying. And this could be a great preventive tool to identify and even empower people who are moving up maybe the corporate ladder or building big businesses and are going to be busy. I see that fitting into that space. Thank you for that, Dr. Judith. That's so powerful.
Of course. And you know, high functioning depression, I joke, I say it's contagious. The reason I say it's contagious is because if you have someone who is that high power being a leader, the culture is going to trickle down to the organization. I experienced it in my lab when I was in my high functioning period. You know, I call it HFAF. It's my joke. Everyone else is high functioning. Everyone else is busy, not really savoring the real things that make being a clinician important, which is the connections between you and the patients, making a positive change. So when you are in a mindset where you're focused on finding meaning and purpose, the people around you, that's contagious too. They'll start to feel the same way. They'll say, you have something, I want that. I want to have that passion. I want to have that joy, that satisfaction that you have. And when you're the opposite, when you're high functioning and busy going through life and trying to get those wins, everyone else will see that too. People who work with you, your family members, it's contagious. Mm-hmm. And I say for my high functioning patients who are parents, I'm like, I wonder, you're feeling burnt out. How many activities are your kids in? Oh, they have painting this day. They have swim. They have this. I said, check in with them, see how much they're actually enjoying these busy activities. And when they check in, they're shocked. Kid doesn't like it. Mm-hmm. Kids like, you never even come. Like, what's the point of this? You know, the kid's doing it to make the parent happy. So I think that you realize that everyone else suffers because, you know, it's contagious.
I love this. This is such an amazing learning for myself as well. And I'm so excited about it because now so many of my conversations with my patients and, you know, everyone else is just kind of, you know, making so much more sense. Dr. Judith, I want to talk about, it's very common for a patient to come into my clinic and with a cancer. And while they're getting chemotherapy and radiation, we do the lifestyle medicine part of it. And when we reach the emotional part, there are suppressed emotions, like deeply rooted suppressed emotions. I'm not talking about day-to-day stress. I'm talking about like resentment, guilt, hatred, maybe a very ugly divorce, loss of a child, deep, deep grief. What we have in our country in India, and I'm sure it exists in other cultures as well, is something that I've now called the mother-in-law syndrome. No disrespect to the mother-in-laws. There's also a father-in-law syndrome, much lesser, but where, you know, fathers want to control, you know, because they have the money in the family and they control everything in the joint family. They tend to also control the son and the daughter post-marriage. But the mother-in-law syndrome is huge in our country. We have women coming up to us saying, Luke, I know why I have this breast cancer. I know it started from the time I've had issues with my mother-in-law. And there are all these issues. We have young moms who are married and are on antidepressants because they just cannot figure out the dynamics between, you know, the mother-in-law. To be honest about it, there's also an identified problem where the husband can't play a role. Because many times when we speak to them, I say, hey, listen, you need to support your wife, not your mom anymore. Okay, you can love your mom, respect your mom, but now this is your wife. But many cases in India, and I'm not here to judge them because the family dynamics are such that he can't say anything either. Because a lot of these families, the money's still controlled by the parents above. And they're living in joint homes. The businesses are still in the father's names or, you know, the generations above. So this creates a very, very toxic situation. One for the husband, he feels helpless. Then the wife starts to judge the husband that, hey, he's a mama's boy. He doesn't do anything to support me. And it just gets worse from there. But we see women suffering. And, you know, I know there's therapy and everything else, but I know you've handled cases like this. Can you talk about this from your experience? What are the tips that you would give mom-in-laws, as well as the daughters, as well as the husbands? Over to you, doctor.
It is a huge problem. I've seen it in clients from Latin American backgrounds. I've seen it from Middle Eastern backgrounds, from European backgrounds, African, and definitely prevalent in India. And I think that the boundaries are just not as clear. I have clients who will say, well, we can't set boundaries because in our culture, if you set a boundary, it's seen as disrespectful. It's seen as you not revering your elders. It's seen as basically inviting a curse, right? What I would say is try to reframe it. You know, think about things using empathy. It is very difficult to empathize with someone you view as your arch nemesis, as your enemy. However, empathy can help you to gain power in a situation where you feel powerless. And I'll use one example of a recent family that I worked with. So the mother was starting to ask the daughter-in-law about sex life, which is completely taboo, you know? Mm-hmm. And this daughter-in-law just kind of felt like, why me? It wasn't like this before. I feel like it's just getting worse and worse. And even when I ask my partner to speak out against it, it feels like it's just worsening, you know? So we did an exercise in our office where it was role play. And I was her, I pretended to be the daughter-in-law and the patient pretended to be her despised arch nemesis, the mm-hmm. mother-in-law. So she had to use a lot of empathy, which is very difficult because she really disliked this woman. And I said, I want you to try to use non-judgmental phrases and empathic interventions. So this took the entire session. We ended up working it out. So I was like, why do you feel like you have to be in my bedroom? You know, why are you asking about my sex life? And through the exercise, she was able to put herself in her mother-in-law's shoes and realize that this mother-in-law is a widow. This mother-in-law lost her husband years ago, probably has not had sex in years. Mm-hmm. Doesn't remember what it's like to be intimate, desperately wants a grandchild, feels like she's not valued anymore, feels purposeless, is interjecting herself into the relationship because she's lonely, right? Because when people are happy and fulfilled and satisfied, they are not trying to ruin other people's joy. They're not trying to steal your joy. So you have to remember that if someone keeps on breaking that boundary to make your life miserable, that means they're projecting that sadness, that, you know, disgust with themselves onto you. And so that allowed her to have a lot more compassion when dealing with the mother-in-law. It doesn't make what the mother-in-law did right, but it allowed her to not lose her cool as much when the mother-in-law set, you know, overset boundaries. And then the mother-in-law started realizing that, oh, these little digs aren't working. These little things I'm doing aren't getting to her. Mm-hmm. So it caused her to back off too. Mm-hmm. Because when someone doesn't react to nastiness, it just makes the person who's being nasty look even more nasty, right? The other situation I treated was a woman who was an outsider in a family, so she didn't speak the language of the family that she married into. And everyone else in the mother-in-law's family would make an effort to speak English so that she felt included, except the mother-in-law. And the mother-in-law would say, oh, my English isn't very good, and say these things. Again, we used empathy. And so in public at these family gatherings, the daughter-in-law, instead of being like rolling her eyes, she would say, oh, it must be really difficult for you to not be able to speak to me in English when everyone else is. Please let me know how I can help you. And then it just, everyone else in the room was like, she knows how to speak English. She's just doing it on purpose, you know, like, so the mother-in-law stopped doing it because she used empathy and non-judgmental statements. It just made the nasty individual look even nastier, right? So I think these very simple tools can empower someone who's a daughter-in-law But you got to have that conversation with your partner. Your partner should not leaving you out to, you know, be roasted like that. Your partner and you should be on the same page. So, you know how we said early in the conversation that no one teaches us how to love, no one teaches us how to parent. Before you even get into a relationship with someone, these are things you got to address. You got to say, if we're going to partner, if we're going to marry, no one else is allowed to interject into our relationship. We're a team. We have the same goal. So if you see your family overstepping boundaries, it's your job to confront your family so that I'm not attacking them, because that puts me in an awkward position. And if I see my family doing that, it is my responsibility to protect our relationship from my family. So you've got to set those boundaries from the beginning. And sometimes even with couples that come to me, I'll say, make it a written contract. Like, say it from the beginning. If you anticipate these issues, go back to the contract. Say, this is not what we agreed to. And come up with a plan. Even if you're already married and partnered and this is happening, you can still do that contract and say, this is how we're going to address these problematic individuals who are trying to steal our joy because they're unhappy, because they're not satisfied, because they feel powerless. This is how we're going to do this together. We're on the same page. We want the same thing. So we have to work together. So it's not too late. If you're already in this toxic situation, it's best to do it together and to have that set rule of boundaries and rules that you follow.
Wow. I love your advice of the couple doing it first, because it's between them. Because a lot of them say, hey, listen, how can we identify red flags before we get married? But it doesn't matter what the red flags are, as long as the couple's got that contract, like you said, you know, either verbally or discussed out. I love that piece of advice. So if you had a message for the mother-in-laws out there, because you are right, a lot of them are also suffering. Also identified a generation gap, because they never had the internet. They didn't have the things that, you know, younger women have today. And there's so much of exposure, so they feel a lack of it psychologically most times. So what would your message be for mother-in-laws over there? What are some of the tips that you can give them to kind of start their own inward journey to identify or make some amount of change? Because I'm sure it hurts them as well to be in this constant nastiness with the mother-in-law and the rest of the family as well.
And for many of them, they had it even worse, right? They'll say things like, oh, you think I'm bad? You should have seen my mother-in-law.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like this hazing, like, oh, I went through it, so you got to go through it. I think that the way to approach it is the same way you would with your partner. We're in this together. We have the same goal. We want our family to be prosperous. We want the grandkids, the kids, the adult children to be happy. We all want to be moving in the same direction. And I'm not here to go against you. I'm not here to take anything from you. You have to reframe it as in we want the same things, because I think that many of these mother-in-laws are not aware. They've probably never been in therapy and never will be, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. They have to see that you want the same things. You have to try and guide them. This is a case where the younger generation is leading the older generation. You're showing them that, listen, we're not going to agree on everything, but ultimately we can agree on some things. We want this family to be healthy. Yeah. We want this family to continue having healthy relationships, positive communication. And there are certain things that will prevent this from happening. If you and I don't get along, that will prevent this from happening. If you and I don't get along, there's going to be tension in the grandkids. You know, there's going to be tension in our marriage. Everyone's going to be unhappy and bitter. So we want the same things. And I think if you can convince that individual to see that you both want the same things, that you want the same goal, that you're framing it this way, they'll have more buy-in. They're not going to be perfect. They're going to continue making mistakes, but using empathy and understanding that their toxic behavior is rooted in unhappiness and loneliness and feeling disregarded and unimportant, that allows you to be a bit more kinder and patient with that person.
Wow. I'm mindful of your time. I know you have a patient coming to you in the next couple of minutes. I could go on talking to you about this. I had so many other questions, but I think it deserves a whole show. I think everyone just needs to like focus on these couple of things that you've just put out there. That's really powerful. Doctor, before I let you go, and I do mean it, I had a lot of other questions to talk about relationships, but I hope we'll have you again on our show at some future date to talk about this a little bit more. I wanted to talk about you. You know, what do you do to maintain your fitness, your mental health? Because, you know, you've been through, I mean, when you look at your resume, you've studied a lot and you've gone through the whole grind. How have you maintained yourself? I've had a look at your reels. There's always this glow on your face, this energy in you, you're fit. I would love for you, because there's an excuse in the world today. Hey, I'm a doctor, so I'm unhealthy. I don't have time. But there are doctors like you who make it work. You know, there are unhealthy pilots and there are healthy pilots. So it's not like all the pilots are unhealthy. So I would love for you, that's part of our show, you know, to inspire people with your own journey. So how have you made it work for your mental health, emotional, your spiritual health, physical health? Would love for you to share that with us.
Well, I always joke that high functioning depression isn't recognized in medicine, because a lot of doctors have high functioning depression. So they don't want to diagnose something that they have, right? And I think that you know, the preventative piece is so important. You can have all the accolades and all the achievements and all the money in the world and not feel full and fed. And for me, what feeds me is I love to exercise. I exercise every day. Even when I don't feel like it, I never regret it. I love family. I love my friends. I've had relationships and friendships lasting from before medical school to present, because, you know, you got to practice what you preach. You know, if you are connected to people that bring meaning to your life and purpose to your life, stay connected to them. Don't take them for granted. You know, for me also, I'm really into fashion. So, you know, a lot of doctors aren't, but I love fashion. I love beauty and things like that. You know, I used to be a little embarrassed to say it, because like when you're in a room full of like all these smart people, they're like, oh, fashion, who cares? I love it. And on my reels, I'm very open about how, like, when I was in training at prestigious programs, I used to have to hide my style. Now I don't care. You know, life is too short. You only got one life. Yeah. So, you know, I do the things that I love unapologetically. Social media was a big risk for me. So, you know, as a psychiatrist, people say, oh, you're not supposed to really put yourself out there. You got to hold yourself to a certain standard. You really can't share too much about your life. Well, we know that's wrong. Now, like, you have all the mental health dominates TikTok. It dominates Instagram. So I think that being authentic is really important to me, and not being something that I'm not, and just showing up as my full, complete self is what that light is. Is that it's that glow in addition to the makeup. But
but I just see it. Happy. Yeah, we can see it. It's natural. And I just love your energy. I have to say that. I just love your energy. It's amazing what you've shared. You've been so generous. And I love the fundamentals of your practice. It just shows simplicity, common sense, wisdom, of course, all the science and the studies that you've gone through put together. I just think it's amazing. And I think you're amazing. And thank you so much, Dr. Judith, for being on the show. Like I said, I still have questions that I'm itching to ask, but I'm mindful of your time. And I'm sure we will do another show together. And you're based in New York, right? You're based in New York.
Yes, I'm in Manhattan. Mm-hmm.
I would love to meet you on my next trip. I'm there almost every 2 months, and I would love to meet you there if our schedules match. But
I would love that. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate you.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Doctor.
Stay tuned for more. We're going to continue our journey, learning, sharing, and evolving.